Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Sarah Nelson. Today we'll be speaking with Dr. Charlie Lederman, who is a lecturer at King's College London. His forthcoming book is Sharing the Burden, The Armenian Question, Humanitarian Intervention, and the Anglo-American Visions of Global Order. In Sharing the Burden, Dr. Lederman argues that the successive Armenian massacres that took place between the 1890s and the 1920s were at the center of debates over humanitarianism and global order at the turn of the 20th century. Dr. Lederman's book challenges the notion that humanitarian intervention originated as a form of international politics in the latter half of the 20th century, and it exposes the way that imperial ambitions suffused the ideas and practices of turn-of-the-century humanitarianism. Sharing the Burden will come out with Oxford University Press in September 2019. Charlie Lederman, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So could you start off with telling us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to this topic?
Yes, so my name's, my name is Charlie Lederman, but I'm a lecturer at King's College London in the War Studies Department. And yes, this is my first academic job. I've had fellowships at the University of Cambridge and at Yale and at the University of Texas. And across that sort of transatlantic existence, that's what allowed me to write this book. So I'm very grateful to those institutions for giving me those opportunities. And I really came to this book really from actually one of my first days as a graduate student. I started doing a master's program at the University of Cambridge. And just before actually I started my program, my supervisor there, Professor Brendan Sims, was doing a colloquium on the history of humanitarian intervention. And he asked me to organize it for him. So that colloquium ultimately became a book on humanitarian intervention. And it was while doing research on that and while getting a chance to hear from some really distinguished scholars in the field that I started to think, well, what would I quite like to do if I was to write something on the history of humanitarian intervention? And through that, I got into a study of the debates over the American response to the Armenian question from the mid-1890s through to the 1920s. And out of that, it became clear to me that that wasn't just, I think, as it had been seen previously, as quite a niche issue and quite a small part of the period. But my sense was that it tied into some much bigger questions to do with the American rise to world power, its relationship with the British Empire, and really the whole conception of international order during that period. My sense was actually there was some big themes that came out of a study of that topic.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So could you just really briefly kind of give us a sense of the status of the historiography when you came to this topic, or what kinds of questions and historiographical debates really fascinated you?
Well, really, the Armenian question, what was particularly interesting to me is that some of the big books on humanitarian intervention and on the response to questions of genocide and the Armenian issue, certainly in American history, have been seen as an important starting point. Samantha Powers' Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, on America in the Age of Genocide, starts with the American response to the Armenian genocide. And there was a sense to which the failure to intervene on behalf of the Armenians during the First World War was really the initiation of a decided, or at least a consistent policy that the United States adopted during the 20th century of, and I think the expression would be sort of an element of indifference from official circles to these questions, even if on a public level there was a huge outpouring of humanitarian relief. And you see the same thing, Gary J. Bass, who wrote a wonderful book on the origins of humanitarian intervention, Freedom's Battle. His book ends where Samantha Power's book starts, with the Armenian genocide and the American response to it, and particularly Theodore Roosevelt's role in advocating intervention for the Armenians during the First World War. So before coming to this question, it was clear to me that this was seen as an important topic, but my sense was that what hadn't necessarily been appreciated previously was its connection to these bigger questions, as I said, of the American rise to world power, how this tied in to questions of the United States' emergence, not just as a great power, but as an imperial power at the turn of the 20th century, but also its relationship with the British Empire. And so recently there has been books that have come out on the British response to the Armenian genocide. There's a number of really good books on that topic. And my sense was that there wasn't necessarily a book that looked at the way in which both nations responded to the Armenian question, tied into these broader questions of Anglo-American relations and the way in which the two powers together wanted to sort of reconstitute international order.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So on that note, before we really dig into the book and the chapter's substance, I did want to talk a little bit more about the framing of the narrative.
Sure.
So, you know, the title itself, Sharing the Burden, The Armenian Question, Humanitarian Intervention, and the Anglo-American Visions of Global Order, I think it really foregrounds that the book is not necessarily about the Armenian genocide, right? And it's not even necessarily about Armenians as a particular people or ethnic group, right? Your focus is really on how the Armenian question cuts across this political relationship between Great Britain and the United States, and how the massacres spur new questions about humanitarianism, intervention, and imperial power, right?
That's absolutely right. My sense was that this was a fundamental issue in, particularly in American politics, and tied into a much broader debate over intervention that we start to see in the mid-1890s, and debates that we see in the United States that tie in with intervention on behalf of other peoples as well. But what occurs in the mid-1890s, the massacre in the Ottoman Empire, what is known as the Hamidian massacres of hundreds of thousands of Armenian Christians in the Ottoman Empire, is seen as sort of the emblematic example of inhumanity perpetrated by a government. So it's used throughout this period to compare to other examples of what are seen as barbarous conduct. That's the expression that's used by government. So that's the comparison is made with what the Spanish are doing in Cuba, what the Tsarist Russian regime is doing to its Jewish population, and also even in relation to what is going on with King Leopold's colony in the Congo. So as you say, it's the book itself is not necessarily about in sort of an inside-out study of the Armenian question. There's a number of very, very good studies that look at the Armenian question in that way. What this book tries to do is to set this issue within these debates about, as you say, imperial power, but also larger questions of international order and debates over intervention.
Right, yes. So I'm really looking forward to getting into kind of more of the details about that in your subsequent chapters. But I did sort of want to ask, you know, as historians of international history or U.S. and the world, you know, often we have to make sure the stories of our less powerful actors don't sort of simply become subsumed or invisible, right, in our story about imperial powers. Is that something you found yourself kind of grappling with as you developed the book's narrative framing?
To a certain extent, yes, but my sense was always that this was a question about how these issues featured within the larger questions of the American rise to world power. And my sense was that this was a debate that was going on in the United States, and I was interested really in how external actors contribute to that debate. So in the 1890s in particular, that is a debate that's going on in the United States, but which British actors are influencing. But by the time we get to the First World War, and particularly the aftermath of the First World War, and I'm sure we'll get into this a bit more in the discussions, but it is something where Armenian Americans in particular, in relations with their compatriots and leaders of Armenian organizations in the Ottoman Empire and in Europe, influence those debates. And it's also something where Turkish figures start to influence those debates when the question is about what the United States is going to do in the aftermath of the First World War. So as you say, it's certainly not something in the 1890s in relation to that larger debate where Armenian actors are playing a major role in that debate. Mm-hmm. But it is something which increasingly, as the story goes on, becomes a much more important issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so as you've already sort of touched on, right, the Armenian genocide itself is usually dated to the World War I years and slightly after, so from around 1914 or 15 to the early 1920s. But you really take the first few chapters to show that the genocide was really a sort of apotheosis of decades and centuries of ethnic conflict and fissures, right, within the Ottoman Empire. So can you kind of give us that broader context across the 19th century and kind of discuss how those intra-imperial tensions were related to inter-imperial tensions between the Ottoman Empire and its European neighbors?
Yes, exactly. So that's a really good point. It's something where you can't really understand what occurs in 1915 without placing it in its broader historical context. And it's why the book is about the Armenian question as it becomes a major factor in European politics, in particular from the late 19th century. And really, it's the case that the Armenians, for a long time, have, even though they've got quite a strong civic identity of their own, they live within the Ottoman Empire in relative harmony for a number of years when they come under Ottoman rule. But by the time you get to the beginning of the 19th century, as the Ottoman Empire is seeming to be in decline, and there's clashes in Europe over what is referred to as the Eastern question of what's going to become of this empire that is seen as moribund and is on the verge, at least in the European mind, of collapse. The famous expression that the Ottoman Empire is the sick man of Europe. Mm. Ultimately, debates start to occur about what's going to occur in the Ottoman Empire, and European powers start to interfere in the Ottoman Empire on behalf of minority groups, and they do so to advance their own interests, while at the same time, at least publicly, talking about the idea that they've got to maintain Ottoman territorial integrity for the good of the peace of Europe. So that doesn't stop them interfering, and it's really in the aftermath of one of these large-scale interferences, the Russian intervention against the Ottomans in the Russo-Ottoman War of the mid to late 1870s, that you get the internationalization of the Armenian question. That war is specifically about the Bulgarians, the famous Bulgarian horrors that William Gladstone in Britain makes a major issue in British politics. But it's in relation to that, when the Russians occupy part of the Caucasus, promises are made to the Armenians, and there's some talk of them coming under Russian control. But the British and the Austro-Hungarians intervened to prevent that from happening because it was going to expand Russian interests towards the Mediterranean, which is something neither of them wanted. But as a result of that, you get this internationalization of the Armenian question, where the powers make statements and promises to secure the Armenian security within the Ottoman Empire. But ultimately, that falls down the diplomatic agenda after the 1870s. But it's really from about that period onwards, as the Ottoman Empire is looking in a particularly perilous state, that the position of the Armenians deteriorates yet further in the Ottoman Empire. And it's this culminates in what occurs in the mid-1890s with the Armenian massacres, where really that is the time where this becomes a major, major international issue. In the 1870s, it's more a diplomatic issue. In the 1890s, this becomes a major public issue across Europe and North America.
Mm-hmm. So I think the book does a really wonderful job of exploring the religious politics, both within the Ottoman Empire, but then also how those religious politics create or exacerbate tensions between the Ottoman Empire and its neighboring imperial powers. So can you kind of flesh out for us what relationship these various ethnic nationalisms and their religious traditions, how foreign missionaries figure in this kind of larger tapestry of great power politics?
Yes, well, the missionaries are fundamental, particularly from the American point of view. I mean, the United States, while not being a player in these big questions to do with what's going to happen with the Ottoman Empire, actually has the largest missionary presence of any nation in the Ottoman Empire that starts from the 1820s and really by the turn of the 20th century has reached a major impact in the Ottoman Empire. And the focus for the Americans is in Anatolia, is in and around particularly the Armenian provinces. So the Americans who go to the Ottoman Empire initially want to convert Muslims, they want to convert Jews as well, but particularly Muslims is their main focus. But ultimately, they're prevented from doing so. They have very little luck with doing that, but it's also illegal in the Ottoman Empire. I mean, proselytizing is something which the Ottomans are not necessarily happy, but they're willing to accept among the sort of Christian minority populations. And that is really where the Americans focus after it becomes clear that that they're not going to be able to have a large-scale conversion process with Ottoman Muslims. And their sense is that these Christians who are, in the Armenian case, they're seen as the oldest Christians in the world. They're the first nation who take on Christianity as a full community. And it's sort of fundamental to Armenian national identity. The sense is that Noah's Ark landed on Mount Ararat, and this is the most sort of important geographical site in the Armenian territories. And ultimately, the Americans build up a major influence among the Armenians. But their sense with the Armenians is that they are going to turn these sort of Eastern Christians into examples of sort of Western-style Protestantism, and that this will then act as a beacon to the empire's Muslim subjects, and that will show just how attractive Christianity can be. But as I said, that's not the United States might have the largest presence. They're not the only power with missionary presences in the empire. The French are quite active, in particular in the Arab provinces. Ultimately, what we see there among these missionaries is that they're playing a larger and larger role in the empire, and they're starting to these communities in the Ottoman Empire, like initially the Bulgarians, who the Americans have a role with, they're basically developing a national identity, and that causes a friction with the Ottoman Empire. This isn't a sense that they're just providing them with spiritual sustenance; they're ultimately providing sort of political outlets. And these nations ultimately rise up against the Ottoman Empire, and the Sultan and the Ottoman government see this as the missionaries playing a major role within this, inspiring rebellion and revolution. And that obviously, as you say, causes major friction. And at the same time, in the aftermath of the Ottoman defeat to the Russian Empire, what happens in the aftermath of that war is refugees from the Balkans, Muslim refugees, are sort of ethnically cleansed into the Ottoman territories. And the Sultan ultimately emphasizes a quite conservative Islamic identity in order to consolidate his fragile regime. But at the same time, this also leads to an exacerbation of tension with the Christian populations as well. So these conflicts that are going on across the Near East, tied in with these with this missionary role in the empire itself, leads to sort of a tinderbox really starting to emerge in the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm. So in your first chapter, you point out that Britain was, for largely kind of geopolitical and economic reasons, really invested in bolstering and supporting the Ottoman administration, especially to contain Russian expansion, which you sort of just mentioned. But American missionaries, as you've already said as well, were deeply embedded in and in some sense supportive of some articulation of Armenian nationalism or a kind of nominal independence. So how does this fit against the backdrop of larger Anglo-American relations at the time?
It's a very interesting question, because this is the time in American public life where the British are seen as the sort of the bête noire of the United States, and obviously in American elections we see again and again the twisting of the lion's tail, a sense to which the British are seen as America's major rival in the world, and ultimately this comes to a head with the Venezuelan boundary dispute of 1895, where you get the United States and Britain really for the last time really coming very close to a conflict. And it's really in the aftermath of that where the British, who previously had been, as you say, had played this role in the Ottoman Empire as upholding the Sultan and his rule against the threat from Russia, ultimately with the outbreak of the Armenian massacres, which are occurring around the same time as the Venezuelan boundary dispute, it's in the aftermath of that you get a sort of a major sort of public outpouring of support for the Armenians in Britain. Both political parties are now very decidedly anti-Ottoman. And the sense is that you can, you're looking around for a way of really trying to strengthen a rapprochement with the United States and moving beyond the disputes that have occurred earlier in the 19th century. And one issue that is seized upon by British politicians, particularly the colonial secretary Joseph Chamberlain, is that the United States has also seen this growth of support for the Armenians in the aftermath of those massacres, and that perhaps you could use that issue and a possible intervention on their behalf as a way to strengthen the bond between Britain and the United States.
Right, right. So, but this calculus of alliances, as you sort of point out, in that Britain nominally supporting the Ottoman government missionaries on behalf of the Armenians, it changes somewhat, right, with the Hamidian massacres. So can you tell us a little bit about what precipitated these Hamidian massacres and what effect they had, both in the Anatolian region, but also in the international community?
Yes. So the massacres that break out in the 1890s, as I say, after the Russo-Turkish War, the Ottoman Empire is in a pretty perilous state. That its finances are struggling. It's lost huge amounts of its territory, and it's lost part of its population in the Balkans, who are then having to be assimilated back into the Anatolian region. And these tensions exacerbate with the Armenians. And ultimately, what the Ottomans do is they're trying to sort of strengthen their relationship with the Kurds in the Caucasus region, and the Kurds are given to a great extent sort of free rein to police and stabilize that area. But ultimately, that leads to major conflict, and really given sort of free rein to target and assault Armenian communities. In the aftermath of that, the Armenians increasingly see the Ottoman Sultan as being tyrannical and no longer committed to their security. And in the 1890s, we see an attempt by the Kurdish militias and Ottoman troops to try and collect a heavy taxation burden on the Armenian communities in Anatolia. And in the aftermath of that, there's large-scale violence that breaks out. And the Ottomans are sort of determined to sort of stamp down on this. Any sense that there could be sort of rebellion against the established order in the Ottoman Empire is to be stamped out. And so ultimately the Ottomans send in troops, and a massacre results. And this causes a huge outpouring of anger across Europe. But as you say, particularly in Britain, which in the aftermath of Gladstone's intervention in the 1870s on behalf of the Bulgarians, has increasingly become a country that is antithetical to the Ottomans for a variety of reasons. The Russians are no longer seen, at least in the public discourse, as much of a threat, and the Ottomans are seen as a really dangerous authoritarian regime.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that sort of touches on another question I wanted to pose to you. I think this particular episode really illuminates how religion figured into race-making of Ottoman Turks, right? How Islam and Turkishness become associated with, as you say, kind of barbarism or barbaric rule. So I'd love to hear you talk a little bit more about how these racial ideologies figured in the ways that observers talked about civilization and what kinds of imperial power were enlightened versus those were that were barbaric.
Yeah, the language of civilization is ubiquitous during this period. And what you see during this time is say the way in which civilization as an idea, it works on a number of different levels. There's a sense to which there's a conception of European civilizations, but there's also a sense to which there's a hierarchy in and amongst these civilizations. So you might see European civilization as being above the civilization represented by Islamic empires and particularly by the Ottoman Empire. But at the same time, within Britain and the United States, there's an increasing move in both countries towards a sense to which Britain and the United States are at the sort of apex of civilization. And what you see in these is this sort of racially rationalized belief that the two nations have this sort of providential mission to unite, to advance some conception of progress and international order. And so that's sort of one side of the civilizational question is on the Western side. And then the way in which they perceive of the Ottoman Empire is, as I say, is at the bottom of this sort of civilizational hierarchy. And as I say, it ties into, in a couple of ways, both seeing Islam as a religion as being problematic, but particularly its political manifestation in the Ottoman Empire is a major issue. And so ultimately what we see is this religious perception of the Ottoman Empire that's tied into a racial conception as well. But I think what's most powerful during this period, because of the role of the missionaries, is that this religious side ties in with sort of a growing language of Anglo-Saxonism as well. So we end up with sort of the way in which sort of Christianity infused Anglo-Saxonism. It's sort of, we see this everywhere in the discussions in this period, and that the Ottomans represent the sort of, as the language of the period, is used as sort of the epitome of barbarism.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I think surprised me most in this book was how the Armenian massacres actually figured in public discourse and in the press leading up to the Spanish-American War. So can you speak a little bit more about how the press and how politicians were imagining a sort of connection between the Armenian massacres on the one hand and Spanish imperial rule in Cuba, especially?
Yes, well, that is one of the things that most fascinated me as well. I mean, it's something which when you're looking at these debates, it's often the case in our questions about the Spanish-American War. There's questions about the imperial motives against in relation to the American rise to imperial power afterwards, tied in with the sort of humanitarian discourse in relation to aid for the Cubans, and ultimately. The language that we see by the sort of yellow journalism of sort of the William Randolph Hearst press in particular is to utilize the Armenian issue and to really turn Cuba into America's Armenia. That's the expression that's used, and that this is something I'm not the first person to have shown these things. Historians of the Spanish-American mm-hmm. War. Have touched on some of these questions before, but I think what was fascinating to me was one how widely used this metaphor and this analogy was, how often the Armenian issue was invoked, not just to suggest that the Spanish were as both politicians and publicists would say the Turk of the Western Hemisphere, and that was one side of it, but it was also to say, well, the Europeans stood by while the Ottomans perpetrated these atrocities against the Armenians, but we will intervene for the Cubans and ultimately show that we are a more moral and more enlightened power. And so that's a language that we see constantly. And it's also something, interestingly, which I don't think has been brought out to a great extent previously, is the way in which the British press also tap into this as well. Whereas across Europe, this is not necessarily something which we see in the European press, this comparison, but it's something which we see in the British press again and again, this sense to which ultimately there is a comparison between what the Americans are going to do on behalf of the Cubans or what they do on behalf of the Cubans and what European powers and Britain in particular should have done on behalf of the Armenians. And so that's pervasive in the rhetoric of the and the discourse of the period. Mm-hmm.
Just absolutely fascinating. So I think this actually provides a sort of natural segue into your second chapter, where you really get to the heart of what we might call a kind of imperial humanitarianism, right? And Theodore Roosevelt looms really large in this chapter. So what does this portrait of Roosevelt help us understand? And maybe what does it not help us understand about the connection between imperial ambitions and humanitarianism in this really crucial period between 1900 and 1910?
Yes, I mean, you absolutely. There's a complex interplay that goes on throughout this period between humanitarianism and empire, which is captured in the language of civilization, which is used in both sections. But as you say, it's an imperial conception of America's sort of role as an exporter of civilization that we see. And ultimately, I think Roosevelt is a fascinating figure within these questions, is that he is really the person who sets the terms of these debates, both on the imperial question and on the humanitarian question, or at least in terms, ultimately it's what he would describe as crimes against civilization, and what he sees as sort of protection of certain persecuted minorities. And ultimately, Roosevelt sees these things as being interlinked. The language that he uses is the same language that justifies why European power should expand into Africa and into Asia. He uses the same language to justify why the United States or why European powers have a responsibility to intervene on, say, on behalf of the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire. And ultimately, I think for a long time, there's been a sort of a corrective in the long-standing perception of Roosevelt as really as a realist figure who's so focused on power politics. And I think historiography has moved on a lot since that sort of perception of Roosevelt as just someone who was sort of the archetypal realist. There's been a sense to which he has these ideals that are very important to him. And in particular, the language of civilization is fundamental. But what I don't think necessarily has been brought out before is how he sort of develops a set of principles on behalf of a certain conception of America's role to intervene, or certainly to protest, and in extreme cases to intervene when what he sees as crimes against civilization are being committed. And I think that's encapsulated in his 1904 address to Congress, where he lays out what I describe as his second corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. And his first corollary to the Monroe Doctrine is well known. It expands America's presence and its sense of America's role of intervening in the Western Hemisphere, and which is sort of seen as an expansionist imperial doctrine. But ultimately, what I thought was very interesting was the way in which he bolts onto this is not just a sense that this corollary to intervene in the Americas, which is sort of seen as the United States joining the European imperial powers in policing the world. He bolts on this second corollary that says that the United States has a responsibility to intervene even when powers that seem to be nominally civilized, such as, say, the Russians, mistreat their Jewish population, or the Ottomans mistreat their Armenian population. Obviously, the Ottomans are slightly hybrid in Roosevelt's conception. They're not... They're certainly not seen as part of the sort of civilized powers, but they are a major power. And Roosevelt justifies America's responsibility to intervene by invoking those examples, both of Russian Jews and of Armenian mm-hmm. Christians.
I was really struck by the quote that you pulled in response to the Russian massacres of Jews, that Roosevelt encouraged his sort of fellow politicians to mind their own Kishinevs, if I'm recalling that quote correctly.
The Kishinev pogrom, I think, plays a major role within this, as it's America's diplomatic response to Russia's pogrom of its Jewish population in 1903. And Roosevelt, at the same time, is also justifying sending American gunboats to the Eastern Mediterranean to protect its missionaries, and at the same time there is an outbreak of a sort of a renewed Armenian massacre after an uprising in the Ottoman Empire. So what Roosevelt wants to do is to justify America's responsibility to do that. And at the same time, other nations are saying, well, what right do you have to do this with what's going on in the United States, what's going on in the American South with its lynching its African-American population? And Roosevelt ultimately delivers this address in 1904, his second corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, as a way of, in his mind, answering that critique and saying why the United States should still be able to intervene when these things occur, at least diplomatically.
So your third chapter delves a little bit more deeply into the connection between American missionaries in Armenia and ethnic nationalism during and after the Young Turk Revolution in 1908 and 1909. So can you give us a little bit of background about the relationship between Turkish nationalism and Armenian regional ethnic nationalism in the lead up to the revolution and during it?
Yes, and it's a really interesting way that you frame that, because I think what the missionaries think at the time is that this isn't necessarily going to be an ethnic nationalism. They see it as the Ottoman Empire reconstituting itself as a constitutional force. And so their sense is the way to solve the Armenian question is ultimately that you turn the Ottoman Empire into sort of this constitutional regime in which the Armenians are given a sort of equal rights with Turk, and they're protected within this new, more constitutional system. And they see this revolution through the eyes of the Ottoman Empire almost reconstituting itself in the American image. And they hold out a lot of hope for the Young Turk Revolution, partly because they also see it as a way that they can sort of expand their evangelical mission in the Ottoman Empire, and that this could then be a route from this sort of reconstitution of a more constitutional system into a way that they can spread the gospel and they can spread Christianity beyond the Armenian population to the wider Ottoman populace.
I do want to tie in James Barton here, because he's a fascinating character, right? And his ideology seemed to illuminate some of these tensions in how the missionaries perceive the Young Turks. So can you tell us a little bit more about James Barton and his engagement with the Wilson administration after the revolution?
Yes. I mean, Barton is a very fascinating figure. And I think just in general, I would urge people to look into the American Board of Commissioners Foreign Missions archives, which are their archives are so vast and they're so well maintained, so that you get huge amounts of material written by missionary leaders that sort of give insights into the politics of the countries where they've been based. So Barton had been a missionary in the Ottoman Empire, but by the time of the Young Turk Revolution, he's moved back to the United States and is really a foreign secretary for the missionary movement, but he continues to have a major interest in what's going on in the Ottoman Empire. And he sees the Young Turk Revolution as being the sort of embodiment of a new wave in international politics of nations moving away from their sort of more established traditions. And as you say, tied in with this language of civilization that all nations are progressing towards sort of a certain end goal that is similar, and that ultimately this would allow the Americans to expand out and spread these ideas of Christian gospelism, and that's tied up in the language. The expression of the time is the evangelization of the world in this generation, and the idea is that ultimately because of the sort of growing interconnection of the world, globalization has sort of allowed missionaries to have these opportunities now to spread the gospel in a way that they'd never had before. And they really believe that that being able to spread the gospel is something which they can do, and that they can move beyond anything that they've been able to achieve previously in the Ottoman Empire.
Mm-hmm. So now when World War II breaks out in 1914, things get complicated, to say the least.
Yes.
So can you walk us through the reasons why Woodrow Wilson's administration consistently refused to declare war on the Ottoman Empire? And what role did Henry Morgenthau play in this decision-making process?
Yeah, I think this is a fascinating question. It's something which there has been a number of studies on, and which, as I say, the Samantha Power book and the Gary J. Bass book have sort of focused in on the refusal to declare war. I think the American decision not to declare war in 1915, when news of the atrocities first comes through, is more understandable. The United States wants to remain neutral. They don't want to get involved in the First World War. The only people who are really advocating intervention, both against Germany and against the Ottoman Empire, is Theodore Roosevelt, who's maintained this belief that the United States has a responsibility to join with the British Empire and intervene both in a conflict that he sees that's being fought for the sort of ideas of righteousness that he's always championed, but also it gives them this opportunity to intervene in the Ottoman Empire that he wanted to do during his administration, but felt that the American public would never back him. But ultimately, the majority of the American public, like Wilson, believe that the United States' responsibility is to stay out of this conflict, it's to stay neutral in this conflict. And Morgenthau finds himself in a very difficult position of being in the Ottoman Empire when he's aware of what's going on. The reports are coming in of just the large-scale mass killing and the what he describes as really sort of the murder of a nation that's going on during this this period. And he is trying to sort of advocate to Wilson that the United States should do more, or he's certainly advocating this to the State Department, that they should do more to protest against this, but ultimately has to accept that the United States is neutral and isn't going to get involved in this conflict. But then what he does do is help to pioneer this relief operation, this large-scale relief operation that starts as the American Committee on Armenian and Syrian Relief, and ultimately becomes Near East Relief, one of the largest private philanthropic operations in American history. And ultimately, the United States sends huge amounts of money in relief to support particularly the Armenians. So that's sort of where we are when in 1917, the United States enters the war against Germany. But ultimately, Wilson resists again and again those who are arguing that the United States should expand its war to the other Central Powers, and particularly to the Ottoman Empire, because ultimately the United States does declare war by the end of 1917 on Austria-Hungary, but never declares war on the Ottoman Empire. It's something which it refuses to do throughout the conflict. And most people believe that this was to do with the role of the missionaries, particularly to do with the sort of philanthropic questions. But I think there's another question here. Obviously, the missionaries have a major influence in this. Wilson has a lot of connections with the missionary lobby. But Wilson also sees, his perception is that in the aftermath of information about the secret treaties that the Europeans are going to carve up the Ottoman Empire, he believes that the United States should remain separate from what the Europeans are trying to do, both in the war in general and in the Middle East specifically. And he thinks that that ultimately the United States, which is an associated power in the conflict, should not be tied to what he sees as an attempt by the European powers to carve up the Middle East on the basis of very narrow imperialistic interests. So that is the other reason why Wilson refuses to declare war on the Ottoman Empire and maintains that to the end of the conflict.
Right, right. So this sort of pivots into your fourth chapter, the Wilsonian solution, right? It sort of gets toward the last segment of your title, the component about Anglo-American visions of global order, as you phrase it. So this chapter explores how the Armenian genocide fit into Wilson's broader calculations, as you're mentioning, about great power politics in Europe. And in this chapter, you sort of set up two opposing camps, right? One is the Wilsonian camp, and the other is the Rooseveltian camp. Wilson, of course, refused to declare war, but Roosevelt, meanwhile, calls U.S. neutrality a national disgrace. So can you explain how each of these camps interpreted intervention in Armenia through the United States' relationship with Great Britain, right? That seems to be one of the main kind of throw lines through your book.
Yes, and that's something which is the way in which they do conceive of it. So for Roosevelt, who's been an advocate from even before his presidency onwards, he sees the United States' interests being tied together with Britain. And he believes that the war is something where the United States should be intervening alongside the other allies and should be an ally itself. He sees Britain as representing not just strategic interest for the United States, but also sharing its civilizational ideals. And so he believes that the United States has a responsibility to do this. And he's particularly angry at Wilson, who he sees as someone who sort of spouts these highfalutin ideals, but refuses to act on them. So as he says in relation to the Ottoman Empire, the idea that we're looking to make the world safer democracy is just insincere claptrap and mischievous nonsense, in his turn of phrase, if we don't declare war on the Ottoman Empire. So that's something which Roosevelt is adamant that ultimately that's his conception of humanitarianism as such, that ultimately powers should intervene on behalf of their ideals. Whereas Wilson doesn't believe, one, that the United States can do anything about this during the conflict. He believes that ultimately the only way that the United States can do anything about the Armenian question will have to be after the war, because it can't intervene in the Ottoman Empire in an effective way. But he also doesn't think the United States should be intervening there, because he's increasingly distrustful of the British Empire. Even though Wilson, as a number of books have shown, has a sort of a strong connection with a certain British liberal political traditions. Mm-hmm. His major heroes are people like William Gladstone, in particular John Bright, and these are people that Wilson idealizes. But he makes a distinction between what he sees as a sort of democratic advanced radicalism and Tory imperialism. And he sees that the British government in the war, he sees as being a representative of Tory imperialism. And ultimately, he thinks that the United States, that their role is not to be leading a certain global order in partnership with Britain. He wants to see the United States ultimately take on a role as a leader in international affairs, separate from Britain. And his sense is ultimately the United States can bring the other imperial powers up to what he sees as America's more elevated standards.
So sort of moving toward the end of the war and the declaration of peace on the Western Front, who exactly were the figures, particularly in Great Britain, that were so desperate for the United States to take up this Armenian mandate? And why were these particular actors so desperate for the U.S. to participate in the League of Nations and global governance more broadly in this particular way?
Yes, I think that's something which I think was something that was particularly interesting to me, because a number of scholars recently have shown the importance of the question of an Anglo-American alliance as being the basis for British conceptions of the League of Nations. What the British want out of the League of Nations is a closer relationship with the United States, and that for British leaders, their sense at a time where they're concerned about their own nation's ability to continue to act as the dominant power in the international system, their sense is that together with the United States, that is the way for Britain to maintain its power, and that the two powers together could basically run the world together. And so with the idea of which nation is going to take on responsibility for the Armenians, ultimately what the British see is that there's a strategic imperative in this, that by a power taking over control of these broader Armenian provinces, and they conceive of an Armenia initially stretching from the Caucasus all the way to the Mediterranean. So this is over a major area. They see it as strategically important because it will protect the route to India, which is strategically important to the British Empire. It will also allow, ultimately they don't want to see the French in there, because they see them as their potential imperial competitor coming out of the war. They don't want to take on the responsibility themselves, because they have their eyes on much more lucrative mandates elsewhere in the Middle East. And so the sense is that the United States is looked to for pragmatic reasons to take on that mandate. But there's also a very idealistic element to it as well, because a number of figures in Britain, influential figures around Prime Minister David Lloyd George, including the Prime Minister himself to a great extent, believe that the way to cement this Anglo-American alliance after the war is through the mandate system, is through this idea that the British Empire and the United States together will govern what are described by Lloyd George and by others at the time as backward peoples. And so this is where you really see the sort of cementing of this sort of imperial and humanitarian language together, that that ultimately Britain wants the United States to come in and take on a mandate for the Armenians as a way of cementing this alliance with the United States. And so these figures include people like T. Lawrence, they include Jan Christian Smuts, and particularly the round table group of individuals around the colonial secretary, Lord Milner. And these figures put at the sort of heart of their belief in the post-war war that the United States should be given some sort of responsibility. For them, they don't particularly care where it's going to be. They just want the United States to take a mandate, because that will be a tangible commitment that will tie the United States into this new Anglo-American-led international order. And ultimately, the decision is taken in the lead up to the peace conference that Armenia is the place, both because it serves Britain's strategic interests, but also because there's a sense to which the United States have had this long-standing connection to the Armenians through their missionaries. And ultimately, that's going to be the way to bring the United States in, is to play on American humanitarian sympathy for the Armenians. Mm-hmm.
And in this chapter, we really sort of accompany Wilson on his tortured and kind of torturous back and forth deliberations over whether the U.S. should assume a mandate in Eastern Anatolia. But I would love to hear you say a little bit more about what's playing out on the ground within Eastern Anatolia and within the central Turkish administration in these particular years. So, you know, what do Armenians want? What are the Turkish nationalists desiring out of a post-war assistance or a League of Nations mandate system?
Yes, this ties in also with one of your earlier questions about the role of Armenian and Turkish figures within these questions, because it's at this point they start to impact on these debates. As I say earlier, they're not necessarily playing a role in the American debates. It's not really something where they're intervening in this. But what we start to see from the end of the war onwards is that on both sides, both Armenian leaders and Turkish leaders are influenced by the Wilsonian language that comes out of the war. This ties in with a lot of the things that Eros Manella has shown in his book on the Wilsonian moment. And ultimately, what we start to see is firstly the Armenians playing on those ideas and are able to get Wilson to commit. And ultimately, their sense, having been quite concerned during the war as to why the United States hasn't intervened on their behalf, or at least declared war on the Ottoman Empire, start to believe that through their close relationship with the missionaries, together they can advocate for the United States taking a mandate after the war. And this is something which the Armenian national leader, Bogos Nubar, of the Armenian national delegation, is sort of at the forefront of this, along with Armenian American communities in the United States, of advocating and getting and lobbying the Americans. And there's a huge Armenian independence lobby group in the United States, which major figures on both sides of the political divide, including leading Republican figures like Henry Cabot Lodge and Elihu Root, are very active on behalf of Armenian independence. So really, the Armenians have a greater deal of support in the United States than almost any other new nation that's emerging. So that's the way in which the Armenians see it. And at the same time, their position is increasingly perilous in the Ottoman Empire, where resources are very much in decline. In the aftermath of the war, communities that had already been sort of spread wide by the cleansing and by the but what had occurred during the war itself, were now sort of starving with lack of food, even though Near East Relief are trying to bring in sustenance to these communities. So they're particularly desperate to get the Americans in. But what's particularly interesting is that the Turkish nationalists also play on these ideas as well, which would seem quite strange at first, wouldn't it? I mean, the Americans have had this long-standing connection with the Armenians. They're very much prejudiced towards the Armenians, supportive of the Armenians. Why would Turkish nationalists be looking to turn to the United States and thinking, well, perhaps we would like to see the United States come into the region and take a mandate as well? Well, in the aftermath of the war, it becomes clear that the Ottoman Empire is going to be dismantled. And the Turkish nationalist figures who are seeing what the British are doing as an occupation force in the Ottoman Empire and are concerned already about what the European powers and their past history with the Middle East, they don't want to see Britain or France take on a mandate for either the Anatolian provinces of Turkey or broader Ottoman Empire. And some of these questions are quite confused in this period as to what is going to emerge from the Ottoman Empire. But their sense is that what they want to see is the United States take on this mandate, because at the time it's not clear that Turkey is going to sort of survive as an independent state. And so Turkish nationalist leaders, including Mustafa Kemal and those around him, are becoming more and more attracted to the idea of at least a short period of American overseeing of or at least an informal relationship with the United States that would allow them to ultimately move towards ultimate independence.
Yeah, on this point, I am absolutely fascinated by the Turkish nationalist imaginary of U.S. empire, right? You have this really lovely section where you sort of describe how these Turkish nationalists are imagining American power over Cuba and the Philippines and sort of marshaling that as evidence of the benevolence of American empire, right? Despite, obviously, the war that the United States was waging against Philippine nationalists. So can you just speak a little bit more about how Turkish nationalists, what the connect, and it sounds like more of the disconnect there was between kind of the actualities of the exercise of American power and what they hoped for?
Yes, yeah, that was particularly fascinating to me, was the way in which, and this is something which we have from the archival record, with a American journalist based in the Ottoman Empire by the name of Lewis E. Brown, attends the Turkish Nationalist Congress at Sivas in 1919, and he meets with Turkish nationalist leaders, Kemal Atatürk, and particularly the Turkish feminist leader Halide Edip, who had been the first Muslim female graduate of an American missionary college. And what these figures are advocating is that the United States, at least in the language that's used at the time, is that the United States should come and do in the Ottoman Empire what it has done in the Philippines and Cuba. And as you say, this it seems surreal and bizarre for these things to be invoked. But their sense is that this is something which certainly appeals to Americans. They're using exactly the same language in the State Department at the time and in and around Wilson. And Wilson himself sees the Philippines and Cuba as sort of a model for what he wants to see other imperial powers do, that he wants to see with the aftermath of the Jones Act, which has passed in the United States, with this sense to which America at some point is promising the Philippines independence, that it, even though it maintains this very much hegemonic role in Cuba, at least nominally is no longer an occupying power there. And so they use these ideas to say in the United States that this is the sort of model that the other nations should go for. This is a more progressive form of imperialism. And the British are also utilizing this as well. They're saying, well, we can get the Americans into the Middle East because they've already shown themselves that they're an imperial power, even though the British are not exactly enamoured with what the Americans have done in the Philippines, and they're certainly not. They certainly don't hold that up as a great example. But they say, well, ultimately they've had some experience of this. Let's get them into the Middle East. But it's something where Armenian leaders and Turkish leaders are tapping into this language and saying, well, ultimately the United States can come and do in the Ottoman Empire what it's done in the Philippines and Cuba. And it's mainly as a way of comparing the United States with other imperial powers and saying that they desperately don't want to see the British or the French come in, because they have far more experience of what the British and the French have done from an imperial degree and the way in which they have constantly been intervening in the Ottoman Empire. And ultimately the sense is that they utilize this language of what the Americans have done elsewhere as a way really to achieve their own political objectives, which is perhaps by bringing the Americans into the region, there's a chance that that they can achieve independence through that. And at the time, it doesn't look like they're going to have much freedom of manoeuvre to establish that independence themselves because of the British occupation forces and the way in which the sort of power balance is very much against them.
So each of your chapters, of course, is sort of structured around solutions, right? So you sort of pose the Armenian question and your chapters proceed. For example, chapter one is origins of a solution. The second goes on to Rooseveltian solution, missionary solution, Wilsonian solution, and so on. Your final chapter is called dissolution, right? And it strikes me that there are at least two kinds of dissolution going on in this chapter, right? One is the United States' refusal to take a mandate for Armenia, and then the other was the United States' refusal to join the League of Nations. And you argue in this chapter that the two refusals were deeply related. How so?
Yes, I mean, the ideas of these solutions previously, in some senses, they're quite abstract, they're quite vague, but throughout this period, going back to the 1890s, there's different conceptions of how you can solve the Armenian question, either by intervention, as figures like Theodore Roosevelt had advocated, or by this sort of more the missionary role of almost playing sort of a civil society role in helping to bring about this sort of constitutional system. Or the sort of more Wilsonian vision, which was less about direct intervention and was more about building a certain sort of international order where national self-determination is allowed and you help support nations on their way to national self-determination. And ultimately, what you see by the end of this period is all of these visions and these ideals collapse in the response to whether the United States will take on the mandate. And what we see in relation to the League of Nations is that both in November, where the League is first rejected, November 1919, the issue of Armenia is used on both sides of the political divide to really push political positions. So for Wilson, he uses sympathy for Armenia in his stump talks around the country to sort of say, well, this is the sort of peoples that we need to be saving, and we need to take on this role in the world in order to support the sort of people that we sympathise with. And then for those who are more on the irreconcilable side of the debate, people like William Borah, the senator from Idaho, or Hiram Johnson, from senator from California, they constantly use the idea of an American mandate as the example of everything they most detest about Wilsonian internationalism. And really, if you join the League of Nations, this is what you're going to be doing. You're going to be sending your boys to police these sort of, as they say, sort of godforsaken areas that they'll get no benefit from, no economic benefit, and ultimately will basically be carrying the can for these European powers. That's ultimately, that's what the League is going to be about. And so it becomes sort of entrenched within this. And it increasingly does, even after the first rejection of the League of Nations, after Wilson's stroke, because in the aftermath of this, Wilson becomes even more fixated on the idea that the mandate question has got to be put to the United States. It's got to be put to the American public. And that is something which he does after the League is rejected for the second time in March 1920. And by the end of May, beginning of June, he asks the United States to take on this mandate for Armenia. And that's is seen by his opponents as Wilson trying to use it as a backdoor into the League of Nations, that if they take on the mandate, then ultimately they would end up in the League by default. But for Wilson, this is sort of the... And by this point, it's difficult to completely assess his motivations because he's obviously a very sick man by this point. But part of the reason he becomes so fixated on this is that he sees this as sort of the exemplar of the sort of order that he wants to create, that the United States will take on this leadership role in the world and they will do so on behalf of these ideals, and that it will do so in a way to provide a light. And as he'd previously said, that the United States will show the way to the rest of the world how to walk in the path of liberty, but which is, in this respect, it's more a sense of that the United States could take on an imperial role that was different to what the other European powers were doing, and that this ultimately would provide an example to the other European powers of what could be done, and would cement America's position as a moral leader in the world. And obviously his dreams for this and the Armenians' dreams for this collapse and they dissolve and it's rejected in 1920.
So what do the debates about the Armenian genocide tell us in the end about the origins of humanitarianism and global governance? So what do you hope is your reader's primary takeaway from this work?
Well, I think my main sense is that this provides a window into an international system that might have been. I think for a long time, this issue, particularly the mandate issue, is sort of dismissed in these studies because it ultimately doesn't happen. But I think it exemplifies the sort of transcending of a certain sort of humanitarianism. I think, as you mentioned before, the growing lack of empathy that the United States and Americans feel for the Armenians by the end of this period sort of shows where the civilizational language and the humanitarian language of the 1890s goes by the end of the First World War. And so it provides an insight into that. But it also provides a sense of, and is seen at the time by different figures as perhaps providing an insight into a different sort of humanitarian intervention. Prior to the First World War, humanitarian intervention as an idea and as a concept exists, but it's on a very ad hoc basis and it's done by powers acting on their own national interests. But ultimately, the sense is by some of these figures at the time is that this could have led, if the Americans had taken a mandate for Armenia, to a very different sort of international system where ultimately an international organization would choose powers to intervene when egregious abuses of human rights would occur, and that they would then engage in sort of a nation-building process afterwards. So it's really a sort of an important junction in the emergence of ideas about humanitarian intervention and global order in that respect. At the same time, it's also something which provides an insight into the different sorts of international order that other nations have in mind as well. So for the British in particular, this was really fundamental to their strategy for the post-war world. And ultimately, their whole conception of the mandate system rested on the United States taking a mandate. And they end up setting up a whole system that they quickly lose interest in after the war. And it's because the United States hasn't played the role that they wanted it to. And for British figures, they see this as a sort of part of the sort of a fundamental point in the decline of British power, because ultimately this whole vision of this Anglo-American alliance that the League of Nations will be built on falls apart. And the whole relationship with the United States falls apart in the interwar period. And at least in the early part of this, the Near East plays a major role in this. So when Mustafa Kemal leads the Turkish nationalist movement to overturn the order established at Paris in 1919, the British blame the Americans for not having taken a mandate, for the whole reason why this whole order has fallen apart, why Armenians are left sort of stateless and vulnerable. So in that sense, you get an insight into what the British say. So as I say, firstly, I think the take home is a different sort of humanitarian intervention is conceived. A different sort of international order might have emerged if the US had taken a mandate, both from the British perspective, but also from the American perspective as well, because these debates over the mandate have such a profound legacy. The language in 1920 during the campaign, Warren Harding sort of coins the phrase to a great extent of America first in this campaign to talk about the sort of things that the Armenian mandate represented, that Harding was thinking of America first, that safety as well as charity began at home, and that ultimately taking things like the mandate was not putting American interests first, that this was sort of a mushy internationalism. And so what we see is the role that this mandate debate plays in the transition from a sense the United States should take on an international role to one which is going to take on a much more narrowly nationalist role and a much more narrowly confined role in the world. So my sense is that the take-homes, I hope, will have will be of interest to historians of international governance of the British Empire and of the United States.
So the book is not even out yet. So this is perhaps an unfair question, but is there anything that you're working on right now, or do you have a dream project percolating next?
I am working on a new project at the moment, which should hopefully be out in a couple of years. I'm working actually with a colleague at the University of Cambridge, Brendan Sims, who I mentioned at the start of this interview, who I worked with on the History of Humanitarian Intervention project. But we're doing a book which is sort of provisionally entitled 5 Days in December, and is about the 5 days in between the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December the 7th, 1941, and Hitler's declaration of war on the United States. And our plan is to write sort of an international history of those 5 days from the major capitals around the world.
Well, Charlie Lederman, thank you so much for speaking with us. This book was a pleasure to read, and best of luck, and we look forward to your next project.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak to you too.